today as August 19, 2003. And members, the order that we're going to be handling our agenda today. First, it's going to be a very quick work session on SJR 2, then a work session on possible introduction of speaker approved bills. Third up will be House Bill 3510. Then fourth will be Senate Bill 911, then Senate Bill 920, and finish up Senate Bill 934. With that, let's open up a work session on SJR 2. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 2 to the Special Committee on Budget without recommendation and that the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded.
Representative Flores has moved SJR 2 to the Special Committee on Budget without recommendation and that the subsequent referral to revenue be rescinded. Discussion, colleagues, this is just a... we're just trying to get this bill over to the Budget Committee, so they're going to have some other uses for it, as well as considering the issue at hand. So we've been asked just to move it over. So and it did have a subsequent referral to revenue, which is now being rescinded, mainly as a means that if it does maintain its... If it does get changed, then we're taking care of that referral now as opposed to having the Budget Committee do it. So, any other discussion?
Okay.
All right. Any objection? I guess we still call the roll on this, please.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, I need to know what we're voting on before I can vote.
Just say it.
That's right. The motion on the floor is to refer SJR 2 to the Special Committee on Budget.
Oh, okay. Rather than deal with it here.
It is leaving our hands.
Okay. Well, I'll vote no.
Okay. Excused?
Aye.
No. Aye.
Chair votes aye, and SR2 is moved to Special Committee on Budget.
Mr. Chair, I was just simply disappointed that we weren't going to take care of it right here.
I understand that.
I was hoping so, too.
Understand that. Let's see. Next is possible work session. Open a work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. And
okay.
Representative Flores.
I would move Legislative Council Draft 3739 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council Draft 3739 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, explain to me a little bit now how this works with SJR 2. I mean, does it become moot if SJR 2 doesn't move on?
This is only being introduced as a committee bill. That where it finally gets assigned is still up to the speaker.
Okay.
So my guess is most likely this bill will get referred to the Committee on Budget.
On budget.
To
okay.
deal with this.
All right. Thank you.
Oh. Okay, this is just the ballot title bill.
Right.
Correct. Any objection to introducing this as a committee bill? Seeing none, so ordered. Close the work session and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3510. And ask Janet Atkins to come forward as the administrator, and we ask Representative Anderson to come forward to the dais.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Come before you today to seek an amendment to Policy 2C of the Oregon Highway Plan of 1999, known as Interjurisdictional Exchanges. I'm joined by my city manager from Grants Pass, Mr. William Peterson, and Mr. Robert Weber, the Public Works Director of Josephine County. But first, let me set the stage for you.
Representative, do you want them to come forward yet?
If you could. Could
sure.
we get another?
Bill Peterson, chair? Robert Weber.
Wonderful.
Am I missing a chair?
Ah, but we've got some.
Sorry, what you said.
Thank you.
In the best of times, ODOT constructed and maintained the state road system. Funds were adequate to keep up with the needs of our highways. As the availability of funds has diminished, pressures have been placed on ODOT to seek ways to accomplish their task. In order to perform the mission and involve public input, ODOT has set up various regional councils called Area Commissions on Transportation. These commissions have laboriously set up criteria that establish priorities for state highway projects, criteria such as the need to provide for growth, highway safety, design considerations, industrial transportation routes, coordination with master transportation plans, cost, and other critical factors that are considered in ranking regional projects. Until recently, these factors were the deciding issues for the Transportation Commission in determining which projects should be completed. And this was so because ORS 366.290 Section 3 Subsection 4, which read, "The construction, maintenance, and repair of state highways should be carried on at the sole expense of the state or at the expense of the state and county by mutual agreement between the department and county in which any particular state highway is located." By administrative rule, policy 2C, excuse me here, by administrative rule, policy 2C, that policy appears to be changing. ODOT is now strongly suggesting that unless a local government entity will agree to accept ownership of a project after completion, the job will not be done. While Mr. Peterson and Mr. Weber will give specifics from Josephine County, I'd like to make the point that this could be like the camel entering the tent. While this rule may be agreeable to urban areas, it can become disastrous for many rural entities. Responsibility used to be with the state or with the state and the county if they mutually agreed. Now it's filtered down to the cities. Cities who, because there's been no increase in gasoline taxes over the last 12 years, are having a difficult time maintaining their own roads, let alone take on maintenance of state highways. The policy appears to be, in order for a city or county to get a much-needed and highly prioritized project done, you must agree to take over responsibility for the maintenance of that project far into the future. Of course, funds will be provided at a level mandated by ODOT, but often those funds will not cover the actual cost. Where will that leave the poorer cities and counties? What will happen to our road system if a city or county cannot maintain their agreement? This bill will allow the state to make agreements with cities or counties if, of their own volition and in the best interest of their citizens, they are willing to and able to assume responsibility for a section of state highway after its construction. However, HB 3510 says that ODOT may not require, as a condition of undertaking the project, that the county or city must assume future cost responsibility for the state highway. This bill returns to the fairness of the criteria we have been using. It prohibits ODOT from moving to a process that, in effect, makes it next to impossible for smaller and poorer counties and municipalities to get their urgent projects accepted and completed by ODOT, even if they rank highly by the accepted criteria. If a local entity wants to help, and if they can, they are free to partner with ODOT. But if they cannot, they should not be forced to shoulder a burden they can't bear in order to get their project approved. I'm asking the committee to forward this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'd ask for your aye vote. With that, I'll turn the microphone over to the two local experts.
Good afternoon. My name is Robert Weber. Is this microphone working for you? Mm-hmm. I'm the Josephine County Public Works Director. Josephine County is a rural county in southern Oregon on the California border. It's about 1,625 square miles, and about 75 to 80% of our lands are in federal timberlands. It's about a 75,000 population county, and we have around 575 miles of road. And what we've experienced in Josephine County, I think, is what everybody in Oregon has experienced, and that is a road user isn't really too concerned whose road they're driving on, state, county, or city. They just want it to be in good condition. And the Oregon state policy of transferring jurisdiction of state highways to local government as, I guess, an incentive criteria on their part to see if a local government would enter into a modernization project has a couple of major disadvantages for rural counties. And I say rural with the inability of rural counties to generate revenue from the populace. I think it takes rural counties out of competition for modernization projects, and I think it's also an unreasonable shift of the maintenance burden to local government that they can't afford to carry. I think some of the belief for the policy as it's written is driven by what the state believes or ODOT believes to be their financial situation, and what I submit to you is the financial situation of our county and rural counties and smaller cities is in a worse state than ODOT's. Some of the examples of that is Josephine County. We're in the process in the last 3 to 5 years of dismantling our annual major maintenance programs. We would usually chip seal, which is just a surface treatment for skid resistance, about 50 miles a year, which is about an 11-year cycle on a 575-mile system. We're down to 20 miles a year at this point over the last 2 years. Our line striping used to be every year, center line and fog line stripes. Residential roads make up about 40% of our system, and collectors and arterials make up about 60% of our system. We've backed off to save money to restripe our residential roads, which is 40% of our system, every 3 years instead of every 1 year. So there's some deterioration for the user. Our average age of our public works fleet is over 10 years old, and we haven't bought a new piece of rolling stock in 2 years. So our interest in modernization projects, albeit we're growing, we're certainly not growing as fast as the metropolitan areas, but we have a mind to keep our effort on maintaining what we have before we move into new projects. Bill Peterson, the city manager, is going to speak a little more about the Fourth Bridge project. There's 3 bridges across the river in Josephine County right now. And there's a need for a fourth bridge project in our urban transportation plan. As part of that discussion so far, there's been around 53 road miles of ODOTs that they're looking to transfer in order to become involved in that project. And in short, they offered some funds which equal around 50% of the cost of maintenance over the next 20 years. And after that, the entire maintenance would be Josephine County's. And we see no improvement in the financial picture other than what's taken place this year by the state legislature, which has been a tremendous boost. What Josephine County intends to do with the 2003 transportation financing package is try and get its surfacing program, its basic keep the cracks from getting rainwater in them program, back up to around 40 or 50 miles. That's what our share of the transportation bill will do, and won't provide any money for new roads. The biggest financial crisis is inflation. It's the unseen one. 12 years ago, we had a budget that was about $2.5 million bigger than what it is today as a total dollar amount. We have more roads and more people in the county. And if you consider inflation since 1991, the increasing cost of things, today we can really only buy $6.2 million worth of labor, materials, and equipment when comparing today's prices to 1991 prices. And we've become highly competitive as a result, and still dismantling our major maintenance programs. The legislative action taken by the current legislature on the transportation funding package is really a much needed help in Josephine County to restore our deteriorating roads and bridges, existing roads and bridges, and extend their life prior to having to reconstruct any of them. The state, county, and city transportation agencies are really basically in the same financial straits with aging infrastructure. We're all in this together. And I think we need to discourage leveraging against the capacity of local rural road agencies or local cities to adequately maintain their roads with the carrot of state modernization projects. So with that, I urge your support of this House Bill 3510. Appreciate your time.
Ms. Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to spend 7 hours on the road to be here and let you know how important this piece of legislation is in Josephine County. Let me introduce myself. I started managing cities in 1975. I started in Wyoming, which actually is in the United States. It's kind of east of here. I remember coming to Grants Pass and being told I was the guy from out east and thought that was kind of a hoot. A guy from Wyoming doesn't feel like he's very east. I've been in Grants Pass now for just over 12 years, and in that time period, we've seen a lot of changes. One of the key things that we're attempting to do is we've got a wonderful town that sits squarely astride the Rogue River, and I do hope you get a chance to come down and catch some salmon and say hi. It's a great town. You'd love it. So it is really hard to drive through. So you got to figure out a way to get bridges over this thing, and our bridges are pretty well clogged up. We've got a couple of them that are the couplet, the 6th and 7th Street couplet through our core town, one on Highway 199 that was constructed about 10 years ago and was a tremendous relief to our transportation system. And now we must find another way across this darn river, or we're going to be just clogged up, and we're going to start looking like driving around here in Salem or going on further up north. And we certainly won't match all the traffic congestion in those areas, but we have serious needs. As we began trying to address those needs some 5-6 years ago, we ran squarely astride the policy that Representative Anderson has identified, and he has agreed to be our champion to try to get us around this mandate of exchanging roadways. And certainly we recognize, Representative Verger, that exchange of roadways can be really beneficial to communities, and the Coos Bay example is a wonderful one where the exchange of roadways actually gave a local government the capacity to get at some things that they otherwise could not do. In our case, we're being literally blackmailed into a position where we must accept some 50-plus miles of roads, which we simply cannot financially handle. Let me use the municipal example for just a minute. There's about 6 miles of roads in the 6th and 7th Street couplet between the two roadways. The road was rebuilt in the year 2000, brand-new construction, about $13 million. You run the useful life of that roadway out 45 years, and you figure the construction cost index near 4%, and figure out what it would take to actually rebuild that thing at the end of its useful life. So you put together a little sinking fund. You realize it's going to be about $350,000 a year that you'd have to put into a sinking fund every year from year one to be able to rebuild it at year 45. And then you look at the maintenance costs. It's got all of these traffic signals up and down the roadway, and you got to stripe it, and you got to maintain it, you got to do all this stuff. You put that together, it's another $300,000+. You get about $670,000 trying to put this road on the road all the time. You put those numbers up against what our total proceeds are from gasoline tax, and you realize you get 70% of every cent you have to maintain all 100 miles in our little town jammed in this one road exchange that we're being mandated to accept in order to try to get what we've got to have to let the state transportation and our local transportation systems function. That's not reasonable. So what we've run up against is with this mandate in place, we simply can't move a project which is critical both to our county and to our municipality. So that's what we face, and we were only a piece of the jurisdictional exchange. The county had the opportunity to accept another series of roads with an offer which would have represented about 50% of the maintenance cost and nothing towards the long-term replacement nor modernization of the roadways that they were being mandated to accept in this exchange. So what Representative Anderson has shaped for us is a piece of legislation that simply allows us not to be mandated to accept. Now, it doesn't guarantee that we're going to get a project or that we're going to be at the top of the pile or this is the most important project in the Southwest region. None of that's going to happen. But it doesn't say that you must accept our jurisdictional exchange or you must accept maintenance in order to get a roadway that can be modernized and improved. So it's an enabling piece of legislation to give us an opportunity to survive and get the modernization needs that we have in our community and county. So with that, we loved delivering the message. It was a great opportunity to come, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I really appreciate the presentation that you've given us today. You've raised some very important issues. I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit more about this project and what it involves and what sort of traffic you've got on it. When I was serving on the Interim Transportation Committee, I know there were lots of disputes about local traffic versus through traffic and business use of the road, local immediate business use of the road versus through traffic. And I wonder if you could talk about those issues.
Representative, I don't have all of the details with me here, but I've got some good generalizations that I can put together for you. The 6th and 7th Street couplet connects to Interstate 5. At its connection point, it's got about 15,000 traffic movements on it. At the peak point on the couplet, there's about 24,000 traffic movements. And at the discharge point on Highway 199, it's about 13,000 traffic movements. So you've got a peaking factor there that is local business use. It's about 30%, plus or minus a little bit, of the gross number of traffic movements on the couplet itself. The clog on the bridge is a combination of local transit movement and throughput movement. Now, most of our throughput has moved over to Highway 199, and that is predominantly now throughput traffic, and 6th and 7th Street is a declining proportion of throughput traffic. However, the biggest reason for that decline is that 6th and 7th Street has this really interesting difficulty trying to get through Grants Pass now. I was recently attending a seminar in Portland. We were talking about traffic congestion and congestion pricing, and we're trying to figure out all these wonderful things, and I'm all excited, and I'm trying to talk to these guys about how cool this would be, and this guy leaned over and said, "Now, where are you from?" And I said, "I'm Grants Pass." And he said, "Well, how's the rush minute there?" It's worse than a rush minute, and I think it's all about your relative perceptions of lifestyle. When it takes you 20 minutes to get through Grants Pass, that is a giant deal in Grants Pass. That's a pretty far cry from what historically has been a 5 or 6 minute throughput. And we're on our way. By 2015, we will be at service level F all up and down the couplet. And that will be a 35 to 40 minute throughput. That's not acceptable to the folks in our community. We've got to find another route around this thing.
Paul, thank you. Where is this road located that the highway department wants you to take over?
6th and 7th Street is the road that they would like us to take, saying it serves predominantly as an arterial through the main portion of the community. They want to accept 199 as a parkway bypass and have us accept the base couplet. And that would just be devastating from our financial perspective.
Now, you were talking about 50 miles of road, or maybe I'm confused here.
Right. Altogether, there's 50 miles. It is the Rogue River Loop. That is some 21 miles of roadway, 42 lane miles. That is a loop that extends from Grants Pass out over the Robertson Bridge and then back around on the Riverbanks roadside to Highway 199. Highway 99, Old Highway 99, which extends from the South Y, where Highway 238 and 199 and 99 all gather currently over to the Jackson County border, and then the 6th and 7th Street. So altogether, we had about 70-plus lane miles and 50-some miles of roadway. Oh, the Capes Highway was the other one that was an interesting exchange that was included in our jurisdictional exchange. It's physically some 30-odd miles from the bridge.
From Cave Junction, well, yeah, it's 30 miles from Grants Pass in Cave Junction, and leads from 199 up to the National Monument, and probably 13, 14 miles there. That was to be included as well. So it looked to us like ODOT was just picking anything they could get rid of and hanging it on the back of the county and the city.
All right. Representative Berger.
I'd like to go back to 6th and 7th Street. All over Oregon, what we have are roads that are actually used by city residents. They're treated as city streets, but at some point in time, they were state highways. And I'm presuming that 6th and 7th Streets are similar to that description?
Representative, I think it would be fair to say that a good deal of local traffic does have to move on 6th and 7th Street, but I would not categorize them as no longer functioning as highways. It is interconnected on one side with Interstate 5 as one of the primary entry points to the community, and it does then discharge the highways 238 and 199, the coastal route and the route over to Jacksonville. So these are throughput highways as well as local traffic devices.
So, follow-up, please. So, they're not a part of your arterial in the city itself?
Oh, absolutely they are. They absolutely are. There are some 16 signalized intersections up and down this segment of highway onto which traffic flows and exits onto the municipal system.
And let's go back to the 42 lane miles. Is that the part that goes to the bridge?
The 42 lane miles is in exchange for Rogue River Loop, and that's exterior to Grants Pass. It is a segment of highway that goes westerly from Grants Pass over to Robertson Bridge and then wraps back around to Highway 199. It's currently a state highway and is functioning throughout the county. Is there something you could say about that one, Robert?
It's most of these highways offered by ODOT in the jurisdiction. In fact, all of them are considered district highways. A state designation is a district highway, and we've been told that the district highways are the highways they believe are not of statewide significance.
Maybe that's the point that I'm getting to. So, explain to me what the leverage is with the jurisdictional exchange and what you want in a modernization project.
What we are seeking as a project is approximately $22 million. It would reconstruct a segment of roadway that would then provide a new crossing to the Rogue River and then interconnect back into the municipal as well as the state highway grid. So that's the project that's anticipated. In exchange for that, the state of Oregon asked from us, not just asked, simply said, without a jurisdictional exchange, you will have no such project. And here are the roadways that you must accept locally for us to consider that project.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, please. Is the $22 million project on the STIP right now?
It is not.
It is not?
It is not. It is on the D-STIP.
Which would be 05, 07, or?
It's on the D-STIP, so it's in the development stage, Representative.
Okay.
Representative Verger, I might say that the Area Commissioner on Transportation has taken, because of the major needs in Medford, Grants Pass and Josephine County have kind of stepped back and said, go ahead. The two interchanges, south and north, in Medford on I-5 have been a major need. And we've been, over the last five, four, six, years, 7 years, we've pulled back and said, you go ahead, but when our time comes, we want you to jump aboard and help us do the fourth bridge. If I could, I wish we had had a map here for you, but there's four accesses across the river. One is 199 that comes in from the south interchange. Then the two, 6th and 7th Street, go all the way through our town from I-5 up to 238 and 199. 238 going to Jacksonville, as Mr. Peterson explained, and 199 going to the coast. The fourth is down here, so we've got 1, 2, 3, 4. The two are our main street, much like 101 going through Coos Bay. But the fourth bridge, the $22 million project, is very, very necessary because there's a major traffic jam between the other three. When they finally get across the bridge, there's a major traffic problem. And this would alleviate a lot of the problem, taking it off of the other three, to get people across the river and out to the coast.
I guess a critical question is, have you worked with ODOT in this matter?
how does one respond here? We've been at this for about 5 years. We've attempted all that we think we can figure out to do. We have attempted to negotiate what the relative value of the lane miles might be in the exchange, and could we accept the exchange, and is there some portion of the exchange which would not be necessary, something different? Is there some other way to try to approach the project? Could we use toll bridges? What the heck could we really do that might be different? We've got files. I brought my three most current files, but I've got probably 5.5 to 6 inches of file space consumed in correspondence back and forth with various representatives from the department. We've had I don't know how many meetings. We brought together the regional problem solving group to work with the Department of Transportation to try to get at this one. We've met numerous times with the ACT. So we've kind of run out of ways to try to approach this from a negotiating standpoint. This is a last resort. We would not be asking for legislation if we thought there was an alternative.
I think the city has been open to making some kind of a deal with ODOT, but not at the price that's being asked. And that brings up the point that I'm concerned about. Cape Junction is in much less capable position to finance projects than Grants Pass, and Grants Pass much less so than Eugene, and Eugene much less so than Portland. I think it's the smaller communities that are going to really be hurt by this. They cannot trade when it's millions of dollars that they just will never have to accept these exchanges. And I think if the city can, and that's the way this is written, if they can make an exchange, if they can come to some agreement with ODOT, that's perfectly agreeable. If they can't, then the project needs to go ahead as we used to, depending on the STIP or the D-STIP. And make it the project that the criteria determined to be, number one, and not drop down because the city or that small town cannot afford to make the exchange.
All right. Thank you. Representative Becklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question could be for any of you, and it's kind of a history question. I'm wondering how the mandatory jurisdictional exchange process evolved. When did it become mandatory, for example, for the local jurisdictions? Was it an administrative rule, or was it a top-down decision? ODOT made the decision and then directed it down to you, or any of those and all of those, please.
You want me to take the Oregon? The Oregon Transportation Plan is what became the basis, and it was the adoption of that plan through the Department of Transportation and their representative board that became the basis, the policy basis, by which the agency is now interpreting this policy 2C to be the basis under which projects may or may not be accepted. So I don't think one would call that an administrative rule in the traditional sense. I think it is a statement of Oregon public policy as adopted by the board. Is that correct? I think that is correct. Am I missing that?
Well, it is an ORIS, so I assume it is.
It is. It was then embodied in the statute.
Okay. 39 highway plan.
In the highway plan. Okay, great.
Further questions?
I apologize.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming up.
Certainly, our pleasure.
And Doug Tyndall.
Good afternoon, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. I'm Doug Tyndall. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Heard a lot of things I agree with in the testimony you just heard. There aren't enough dollars to maintain the transportation systems on any of the systems, be that city, county, or state. I definitely agree with inflation concerns and worry about that all the time in terms of maintaining highways. And also that the cities and counties are getting some revenue for operation and maintenance as part of the new revenue package. The state is not getting dollars for revenue or new from that revenue package for operations and maintenance.
So, Mr. Tyndall, that revenue or that transportation package we just passed isn't enough for you?
There's Oh, that's plenty. Don't get the idea that I'm arguing against that package, sir. I'm just talking about the way the money's divided up in it. Oh, I thank you very much for passing that transportation package. It's a great thing for Oregon. I think some of what you heard is that we wouldn't, I don't believe, say that we have mandated a transfer. I'm not going to disagree that that's what the local government's heard. And so to make sure that we're not too heavy-handed and we're saying the right thing, we're working with the local governments, Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities, to try and put some sideboards around this jurisdictional transfer issue. When does it make sense? Basically, what we're trying to do is the policy that was discussed in the Oregon Highway Plan endeavors to put the state resources on those highways which are of statewide importance to go across the state or across regions or travel between cities. And so that's sort of the genesis about where this is coming from. In particular concern with the bill, and I'm very glad to hear Representative Anderson say, I don't believe this is the intent. The way that we write an agreement to do a modernization project with a local government includes a number of facets. What's going to be included, and if a jurisdictional transfer is going to take place, it's generally in that agreement. And so we were afraid that the way the bill was worded, it would take away our flexibility, or may take away our flexibility. Certainly don't disagree with them that we could still do jurisdictional transfers. It just may make it more difficult as part of a modernization project. I definitely understand and sympathize with any county road master or any city public works director and the problems that they're facing. Every story you heard, I'm sure, is true. It's happening everywhere. It's happening in the state. We can't do things as often and as well as we used to. So I definitely don't disagree with them. I definitely agree that that is a problem, and I can certainly appreciate their concern. And I just want to reassure you that we are, ODOT is committed, whether this bill passes or not, to working with local governments to put the sideboards around all jurisdictional transfers so that we're all on the same page about when it makes sense, when it's going to benefit both parties. I would also mention to the gentleman from Grants Pass that if he's worried about blackmail, you don't need to pass another bill. It's already a crime in this state. But
not when it's approved and I guess by the government.
Thank you. I'd be glad to answer your question.
President Berger?
Yes. There is the 6th and 7th Street apart. Are you familiar with the Grants Pass issue?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is the 6th and 7th Street a part of the local street system?
Well, it's one of those cases that's becoming, it's a little bit different than, say, 82nd Avenue in Portland, where which is purely a local street, happens to still be a state highway. But as was mentioned, with the shift of traffic over to 199, it's becoming, and I don't know what the exact numbers are, the folks from Grants Pass could probably tell you, but it is still on the state highway system, but it's serving a function in addition to through traffic, and more local traffic on that roadway. It's right in the middle of the, you go right through the middle of Grants Pass if you're on 6 and 7.
Follow-up?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to refer back, and I thank the city manager from Grants Pass for mentioning the success of Coos Bay. We did two jurisdictional exchanges, one with Ocean Boulevard and one with Newmark, and we were able to put the amount of money that we received in that in the bank and passed a rule that there would not be any touching of the principal but only the interest. The interest started drawing money. There's been very minor maintenance on both of the roads. The Newmark Road was not on the STIP or on any place for the next 20, 25 years. So nothing was going to happen to Ocean Boulevard or Newmark. And by including urban renewal dollars with the interest drawn from the Newmark property, Newmark will now be a four-lane road, or three lanes with the turn lane, I'm not real sure, because they've been working on it since I've been in session. But it will go all the way out to join the beach road. This would not have happened in 25 years had it not been for the jurisdictional exchange. So I thank them for recognizing the fact that it can be an extremely positive thing for ODOT, and it also makes sense where it is a part of the local street system. Even though these were treated, they were state highways, and they did go to the beach, and they are used in a way as a state highway, but they're very much a part of the local street system, residential system.
Thank you. Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, in the second sentence of your introduction, you indicate, quote, it does not prohibit an agreement between ODOT and a local government to make a transfer for other types of projects. You indicated that if this bill passed, it would make this more difficult. Why would that be?
I'm sorry, Chair Doyle, Representative Backlund, sorry if I misportrayed that. I said it would be more problematic on modernization projects. It will not change the current process for jurisdictional transfer as part of other projects, or just a jurisdictional transfer as part of us moving money, or a local wanting to take over the road. Sometimes locals want to take over the road because they want more control. So what I was referring to is only what this bill addresses, which is modernization projects.
Okay. Follow up?
Sure. Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you. Would it be true if this bill passed that the projects that were described by Representative Verger could still have taken effect in Coos Bay?
Representative Doyle, Representative Backlund, yeah, they still could have gone forward. It just would have been a little bit more of a negotiation process in terms of when did the city take the road. Did they take the road after we gave them the money, or did we give them the money and then they took the road? Instead of make it as it was part of a one single agreement. So it was essentially a condition of the agreement.
Right. Thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Oh, Representative Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to puzzle this through, and I'm still having a little trouble with it. This has been a general policy, hasn't it, for ODOT for some time to try to get roads which are primarily city streets out of its inventory and concentrate on traffic that's going longer distances. Isn't that true?
And Representative Doyle, Representative Barnard, yes, that's correct.
Yeah, that's what this is about, isn't it, from your point of view?
Yes, it's a tool that maybe we haven't used as well as we could have in the past, and we're hoping to work through with the cooperation of local, the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties to make sure it works better, and leave it as a tool to get exactly that mission accomplished. Just to streamline, so you have a state highway system that is truly a statewide significant highway system.
Okay. If this bill were to pass, what operational differences would it make for ODOT?
Chair Doyle, Representative
Fanny.
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, it would be in the. It would make, as I'm trying to explain, I'm not getting this across, I'm searching for the right words, doing a jurisdictional transfer as part of a modernization project would become more difficult. In terms of our other operational aspects, it won't change anything. But it will be more difficult because it says that you can't condition a jurisdictional transfer as part of a modernization project, and we read that to say you can't put it into the agreement that results in the modernization project. It's not, as Representative Anderson said clearly, it won't stop those from happening, just makes it a little bit more difficult. Takes the tool away.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for testimony. Bill Penhollow and Linda Ludwig.
Good Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. And in recognition of the hour, I will be brief. Mr. Chair, we support House Bill 3510. It's a situation where ODOT, cities, and counties are all faced with a lack of resources. I know at the county level, we have about $1 for every $4 in needs that we have on our system. The county system currently is 27,000 miles of road across the state. The city system is some 9,600 miles. And the state is about 75,000 miles, though they have many, many miles of interstate, which are multi-lane routes. So it's a matter of trying to address maintaining this total system with $2 to $3 to $4 in need for every dollar that you have in revenue. So we look at this and feel that as cities and counties do by statute, when there's an issue of jurisdictional transfer, the jurisdiction should come together, sit down at the table, to see if they can work out the arrangement to make the transfer and not try to hand off roads that are in major need of improvement to another jurisdiction. We have in statute a provision that requires that cities and counties come together on a jurisdictional transfer. Either the city or the county can initiate the consideration, but both the city and the county ultimately have to come together and agree. That has been really the practice of the state of Oregon over the years, because I've been around here several sessions and working with several different administrations at ODOT. It has only been recently that this kind of approach has become more and more common because they are faced with the problem of what are we going to do with these district highways that they are unable to maintain. And the cities and counties are unable to assume the maintenance of those in the condition that they're in. So it's a real conundrum. Mr. Chair, let me stop at that point. I'd be happy to respond to any questions if there are any.
Linda, why don't you go ahead?
Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. Mr. Chair, thank you this afternoon, members of the committee. Basically, I would just like to say ditto to what Mr. Penhollow said in supporting the bill. We believe that these jurisdictional transfer cases are important to be discussed and decided upon as a case-by-case basis. And I guess that we would probably disagree with the interpretation that the language in the bill would preclude that happening for modernization projects.
Questions? All right. Thank you for testimony. And that concludes the public testimony on House Bill 3510. So we close the public hearing and open up a work session on House Bill 3510. Mr. Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3510 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Flores moves House Bill 3510 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like there was some problems between Josephine County, Grants Pass, and ODOT, and that there was some probably, maybe it wasn't handled in the best way possible. But this is a major policy change, and we're taking away a tool that ODOT and the jurisdictions have had, and they're statewide, there have been numerous partnerships that have resulted from this these transfers, and it has worked very well. And I would hate to see this go away. I'm not disagreeing with the problems that the cities and counties are having with money, but we at the state level are also having problems with funding also, and it needs to be a cooperative effort among all three. But I would be opposed to making such a big policy change as this.
Further discussion. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Representative Mons Anderson's comments. I will, with some reservation, however, support the bill. My dilemma here, having gone through personally as a mayor in making a jurisdictional exchange in a smooth way, and I'm disappointed when particularly you bring in community solutions teams and this kind of thing, that there's not some real effort to resolve the problem. I think it should not be arbitrary and capricious. In other words, and I think it's it should not have an attitude of you'd better do this or you're not going to get anything good in the future. And I've not had that experience, but I don't like it. I don't like to hear about it. I have to agree, however, that I hate to see anything change from what I went through because it works so well. But I will, with some reservation, support the bill to get it out of committee.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I think it's noteworthy that because Grants Pass happens to be the object of this discussion, as Representative Anderson started out by saying, this is an issue that faces rural areas, cities and counties. They have difficulty in funding on a trickle-down level, and I think that as a policy, it is a strong voice to support that difficulty and help them in a way that can be very positive. And I will be supporting this bill.
Representative Backlund?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that if the bill stopped at just prohibiting ODOT from requiring another jurisdiction to assume responsibility, we'd have one thing to consider. But I think since it does not prohibit an agreement between ODOT and local governments, I think that kind of changes considerably. And so to me, this bill is reasonable because there are possibilities for agreements. Doug Tindall has said it would be more difficult, and I can acknowledge that. There would be more negotiations, most likely, but they would not be impossible to complete. So I think this is probably a reasonable answer to an issue that's very important to cities and counties.
All right, further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In some ways, this feels like a statute in trying to deal with the relationships between cities and counties and ODOT sometimes feel like a clumsy method for trying to regulate their interactions with each other. And so much of this seems to me is related to the way people actually approach these problems, and I'm not sure whether a statute like this will actually help. It might, but it might not too. If I understand correctly from the testimony and from what other members of the committee have said, this bill really is not intended to prevent the department and other jurisdictions from agreeing that they can do a jurisdictional transfer in the context of a modernization project, but only that the department can't require that as a part of the modernization project. In other words, if I understand it correctly, the department and another jurisdiction could agree in the same document with a modernization project that there will be a jurisdictional transfer. If I understand the bill correctly, what I just said is a true statement. I'm getting nods, and I'm hoping that that's what that means. And I'm hoping that's what Section 2 means. It's not clear to me that this bill actually is going to improve the situation very much. I suspect that if ODOT decided that it really wanted to insist on a transfer as part of a modernization project, it would simply be couched in different terms and discussed in a different way. And I'm hoping that that's not what happens. I do have to say that the context in which this has been placed is not very, very persuasive to me. I'm not an expert in transportation, but it does seem to me that city streets ought to be maintained by a city rather than by the state highway department. And what they've described so far sound like city streets. The way this is actually put together, I don't know. I'm not sure that we actually get to the problem that they're trying to address. The real issue, of course, is adequate funding for maintenance of roads, rather than who's going to do it. I think, Mr. Chair, I've talked myself into voting against this bill here. And I'm sorry to take up so much time while I'm pondering it. And two reasons for it. One is I don't see that it's likely to actually help deal with the problem that has been addressed to us. And the other is I think that this late in the session, with the minuscule hearing that we've had on the bill in an area which is relatively complex, that this is the kind of thing that ought to be taken up by the Interim Transportation Committee as a part of dealing with the overall problem of how we interact between cities, counties, and the legislature. I'm not saying I'm necessarily opposed to the concept, but I think this is the wrong forum, the wrong time, and with the wrong amount of research.
Okay. I'm looking to support this bill. Looking at the full context of Section 2, I do believe, as Representative Backlund stated and Representative Barnhart concurred, that the agreements are allowed. Even on the highway modernization projects, it will be allowed. And really all it's doing is a recognition that there have been cases where the Department of Transportation has used a heavy hand in trying to exert some influence on certain cities and counties in ways that basically it's a cost shift to the taxpayers. And for no other purpose but to relieve the load of the state, so that then the local cities or counties have to bear a burden that ultimately the state has designated on their own, as you know, some way having taken responsibility for those particular highways. So it seems to me that this does make sense. It's something that it's such a heavy-handed tool that this, I think, merely just levels the playing field a little bit more for cities and counties when they negotiate with ODOT on these issues, and it's a worthwhile piece of legislation.
Mr. Chair.
So with that,
Representative Barnhart. Thank you. Representative Close has pointed out to me an error in my understanding of the bill, and I'd like to refer to that if I may. I am now holding in my hand a copy of the staff measure summary on the House Committee on Transportation when this bill went to them, in which all of the members of the committee supported the measure, which means, of course, that it's been through the process that I complained that it ought to have gone through. I'm going to vote in favor of the measure.
Thank you, Representative Close. And Representative Barnhart, anytime we can continue to help you with your therapy, just let us know.
Mr. Chair, this is the session. I appreciate that.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Moss.
Yes, I didn't realize that either. That this had actually gone through the substantive committee.
This is one of those bills that went to Ways and Means and came back, isn't it? Thank you. I just simply didn't realize that.
It went through the Transportation Committee,
it did.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. All right.
I will be a yes also.
Okay. Call the roll, please.
Yes. Aye.
Aye.
Representative Post. Full time.
Representative Morris.
Aye.
Representative Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Chair Boyle.
Chair votes aye, and we'll ask Representative Anderson, Gordon Anderson, to carry the bill to the floor. Thank you. That closes the work session on House Bill 3510, and Now we can open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 911.
911, okay.
And ask Linda Swearinger.
Representative Doyle, members of the committee, my name is Linda Swearinger, and with me is Bob Courtright from DLCD. Many of you know that Senate Bill 911 actually started out as House Bill 3213 and actually passed the House and ended up over in the Senate, and it's had a life and death experience, and it has been resurrected as Senate Bill 911. But the good news is, after it left the House, we were able to work out several compromises to bring DLCD on board, and Bob will talk about that in a minute. But basically, what this bill does is seven things. The first thing is it changes the overnight lodging from 45 weeks to 38 weeks, and it allows the resort owners to count overnight lodging that is run through a real estate property manager as opposed to just the resort. One of the problems that we've had is, it's important to be able to count overnight lodging. We were only able to count lodging that was within the central reservation service of that particular resort. So there were a lot of properties that were being rented that weren't being able to be counted. So we made a change in that provision. There's also a change in the phasing criteria. As you know, you've got to build 150. The first 50 can be constructed or bonded in the first 5 years, the next 50 in the following 5 years, and finally, within 14 years, you need to have all 150 built. And so we made that change. The other is we put in a provision to provide for some accounting on an annual basis to maintain some accountability on the part of the resort owners. And then we changed the ratio from 2.1 to 2.5 to 1, which would allow several more lots to be constructed. Now, it does not change the total amount that a resort can build. That's still up to the county. So if they've approved 1,000 units, it still stays at 1,000, but it allows a difference in mix. And then the destination resort mapping, there's a problem since we don't have periodic review as often as we've had in the past. In fact, counties may opt not to go into periodic review. The law is required that the only time you can change your destination resort map overlay is through that process. And we've made a change to allow a county to allow that process not to take place any sooner than every 30 months. And then finally, in an effort to move the bill along, we agreed to have it only applicable to Eastern Oregon, so it does exclude Western Oregon. And you're going to hear testimony in a little bit wanting to include Southern Oregon. That, from our standpoint, is an unfriendly amendment at this point in time. We've worked very hard with the governor's office and DLCD to come up with a bill that everyone is supportive of. Well, not everybody. You'll also hear, I'm sure, from our opposition, but at least we have support from DLCD, and the governor's office is supportive as well. And there is one other thing. There is another amendment that will be offered by AOC. And we agree with the amendment, which says counties have the right to be more restrictive than state law. However, we have one concern with this particular amendment at this point in time. Our belief is where the session is coming to a close very rapidly, or at least the hope is that it's coming to a close very rapidly, that we may not have time to have it concurred in the Senate. And so we would leave that up to your judgment. We believe, as a practical matter, and as a former county commissioner in Deschutes County, I can tell you this. The county has always been, when it deemed necessary, more restrictive than state law. And they have always charged fees for changes within the legislative process as well. And so that's the county's concern. We believe they have the right now to charge fees for legislative changes, and they have the ability to be more restrictive than the proposed state law. And we believe this based on the practice that is occurring currently in Deschutes County, and our belief is that that should be their right as well. But we would leave that up to you if you believe that it can pass in this committee onto the House floor and be concurred in the Senate, we don't have a problem. However, we would hate to see all the work that we've put into this bill come to an end just because of the close of session.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Courtright with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I think Linda's done an excellent job of summarizing the process that this bill has been through. Our interest has been assuring that what we get as we continue to tinker with the formula for destination resorts is, in fact, destination resorts that attract and serve visitors to the state. I think what we've been able to draw on, given Linda's experience as a county commissioner, is the pretty substantial experience in Deschutes County, and that's one of the reasons that this bill has been targeted to Eastern Oregon. Oregon is to continue to use that as kind of the benchmark for how we do destination resorts in the state. And we're satisfied that the changes that are made continue to achieve that broad policy objective of getting destination resorts without undermining the protections that we're interested in retaining.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Art Schlack.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 911 with the Dash 8 amendments that you are being handed at this point. When this bill was in the Senate, we identified a couple of issues with the proponents of the bill, and it was our understanding with the proponents of the bill that we would address those issues when the bill came over to the House. The bill's over to the House, and we're here at this point to address those two issues. I will mention to you that it is Deschutes County that raised the issues that we've been discussing with proponents over the last few weeks. It is their legal counsel that brought the concerns to our attention, and we believe it's important to make two clarifications at this point in the bill at this point. And if you take a look at the Dash 8 amendments, these are both small or short inserts. The first one is on page 2 of the bill, on line 29. After the word must, we would request that you insert unless required by a local government to meet a more restrictive standard imposed by the local government. This makes it clear that the local government can be more restrictive than what's provided in statute, and there's a major concern within the bill with respect to some of the provisions that deal with bonding, the county accepting surety bonds for some of the units that are enumerated within the bill, some of the condominium and multifamily units with a four-year kind of time frame for those surety bonds. Some counties may or may not wish to accept those for at all or for that length of time, and it does have a impact on the fiscal responsibilities of the county. The second amendment is on page 5, line 13. After the period, would just insert the addition of and may charge a reasonable fee to cover the cost of process to make it clear that the counties have that ability when they accept applications for processing outside of periodic review at this point. And with that, Mr. Chair, with the Dash 8s, we would support the passage of the bill, and I will make a commitment, should you include those, to work to see that this bill passes the floor and that it's over to the Senate in a timely manner and it's concurred with before the end of session, which I think we have time for. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Art, do you agree that local governments are not allowed now to set more restrictive standards?
Chair Doyle, I believe that in some instances, local governments have the ability to do it. Sometimes it's unclear as to whether we have that ability and in what circumstances. And the Dash 8 amendments would have a clarification so there would not be litigation later on in terms of that capability. As I indicated earlier, it was the legal counsel for Deschutes County that raised these issues.
And yet the prior testimony was that Deschutes County already does set more restrictive standards, so have they had litigation?
Chair Doyle, I do not know whether they've had litigation on this case in point, and it may have been the practice of other boards in Deschutes County to do that, but I'm not sure at this point.
Okay. And then do you see that this legislation does not allow a local government to charge a reasonable fee for those maps?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's unclear at this point because it says that you must process it within these other times and removes the periodic review, of which local governments had the ability to get periodic review grants to process these types of amendments in the past.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Backman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Art, you've made it clear that AOC supports the Dash B8 amendments. Does that mean if they are not included, the AOC opposes the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, AOC would be much more comfortable with these amendments in the bill. I will not say that we would oppose the bill, but when legal questions are raised by county councils in good faith, we believe that those should be addressed. And it's good to have things clarified so that we don't have litigation in the future.
Further questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
And Martha Pagel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with the law firm Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt in Portland, and we are here today on behalf of clients who are interested in destination resort development in Jackson County. And I have to start out by saying that timing is everything, and our timing is really lousy on this bill. It's late in the day, it's late in the session, and I've been informed that it's very late for us to try to enter into the process. So, having said that, I just want to make some points briefly for the record. One is that we do support the concepts that are in this bill, and we do support the bill. If we had come in earlier, I would be here today urging amendments to include at least Jackson County or Southern Oregon or the whole darn state in this bill, because the changes that are in 9/11 are useful to the destination resort siting process without, I think, undermining the basic, the fundamental purposes of our land use system. So I'm very sorry that I am not offering you amendments to include Jackson County. We had some reason to believe that the bill might be slowed down with other amendments, and if that were the case, we'd sort of be saying, me too, that we would like you to reconsider that issue. If that's not the case, then we do not want to come in as a spoiler on this bill. I can appreciate the hard work that's gone into it by a lot of folks and wouldn't want to undermine that. We would say that if we can figure out another vehicle this session, or if not next session, we hope to be back to talk about Jackson County.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? All right. Thank you for testimony. And Carrie McLaren.
Thank you, Chair Doyle, members of the committee. My name is Carrie McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I'm just going to highlight portions of my written testimony that was being handed out to you. 1000 Friends of Oregon opposes Senate Bill 911 because we believe, in our opinion, that it's contrary to the express purpose of destination resorts. Unlike the testimony that you heard from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, we respectfully disagree that this does not undermine the protections in existence statute, and do have substantial concerns that what we are getting are not destination resorts but rather residential developments.
And just very briefly, a bit of background. Goal 8 was enacted with respect to destination resorts as a result of a joint commission between the Economic Development Commission and the Land Conservation and Development in 1982, and they came out with a report in 1983. One of the clearest findings and recommendations from that 1983 Joint Subcommittee report reads as follows, and I quote, "Destination resorts must provide primarily visitor-oriented accommodations to assure that they are not built as or evolve into full-time residential communities." In issues as this has come up legislatively over the years, there has been expressed a fundamental concern that destination resort provisions might be misused to allow residential subdivisions. As recently as 1993, when some of the ratio was changed there, the Department of Land Conservation and Development specifically requested changes in the destination resort provisions to assure that it remained consistent with the original intent of Goal 8, which was not to allow the laws to become loopholes that would not allow rural subdivisions. And the reason for this is rather important. It's clear that, in the opinion of the subcommittee, that residential use does not provide the economic development opportunities that's used to justify the siting of destination resorts in rural areas. Just quote the beginning part of it. The rest of the paragraph explains why on page 2. But their conclusion was that destination resorts that evolve into full-time communities, cities, or retirement centers will not result in the desired economic benefits associated with tourism. It's important to remember this is a tourism-related development. We're talking about attracting people, ideally from outside of the state, for extended periods of stay in the state. Thus, it is very clear from both administrative and legislative history that the Commission and the Legislature did not intend to authorize as destination resorts rural residential subdivisions. In my opinion, that's exactly what Senate Bill 911 being gross does. We have to read all of the provisions together, but taken together, as Ms. Swearingen outlined them, one, the number of weeks that an individually owned unit must be made available to count as an overnight lodging unit has been reduced from 45 weeks per year to 38 weeks per year. Secondly, the ratio of the number of homes that may be built to overnight accommodations has been increased by 25%. You need to take that into consideration with the fact that as you count more of these individually owned units as overnight lodging accommodations due to the reduction in the weeks, that also increases the number of homes and the ratio that you can build. Finally, as she testified, instead of requiring that the destination resorts would be phased in over a five-year period, at least with respect to overnight lodging units, these are not actually required. All of the lodging units are not required to be built until 14 years after the development has started. I think what we start to see here is something that very much could be built as a residential development, not as a resort, not with the economic development opportunities that this goal was designed to provide and these statutes were designed to implement. Therefore, we urge this committee to vote no on these amendments. We did propose, and I want to make very clear for the record, that we did not object and we still do not object to revisions that give resort developers additional flexibility in developing destination resorts. We agreed very early on with the proponents of this bill that including property managers as a overseer of the rental units was appropriate as more people were beginning to use the property managers and not the destination resort itself as a manager of those overnight accommodations. We did even agree to some reduction in the number of weeks that overnight lodging units needed to be made available. We also asked for some sideboards that we could feel would assure that these would not be developed into residential communities. We were not successful in those endeavors, but I want to, you know, sort of make clear for the committee what our goals are here with respect to destination resorts and the siting statutes. With that, I will close. If you have any questions, I would be more than happy to answer them.
Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two, I think. Maybe three. What is the definition of Eastern Oregon? I see it's defined as an ORS 321.405. Do you know what that definition is?
Yes, it essentially, Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, it essentially runs along between the Wasco and Hood River County line. So Hood River is Western Oregon, Wasco County is Eastern Oregon, then runs down the Cascades. Klamath County would be considered Eastern Oregon. Jackson County is Western Oregon, and it goes down to the California border there.
Okay. Second
follow-up?
Second question. I'm having trouble following your logic, and I want to make sure I understand it. You indicated that this is a tendency toward going, instead of being a destination resort, to become more residential. And one of the arguments you used to support that is that we've reduced from 45 to 38 weeks the amount of time it has to be available for rental as a presumably to a tourist. What residences do you know about who only stay in their house 14 weeks a year?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, I apologize for the lack of clarity. The way that the homes work, there's a ratio, and this bill would increase the ratio from the 2, which is currently in statute for Eastern Oregon, to 2.5 homes per overnight lodging unit. An overnight lodging unit, an individually owned unit, that is available for rent X number of weeks per year, in this case now 38 weeks per year, is allowed to be counted as an overnight lodging unit. You can build two homes or sell two lots for every overnight lodging unit that you have as part of your destination resort. The conclusion I was attempting to reach by my analysis was that if we bring more individually owned units within the ambit of what constitutes an overnight lodging unit, we are also helping to increase the number of residential homes that way, aside from just also the increase in the ratio. Okay. I don't know if I've been entirely clear still.
Well, if I could follow up, I wonder if you haven't already lost the war. If I understood what you said correctly, the developer can build and sell two houses for people who live in permanently for every one house that he keeps or sells as a rental unit. Is that what the current law is?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, that is, and to that extent I would agree with you that there you could underscore part of my analysis by saying this is making a law that is potentially already not workable, even worse in some situations. We were recently involved in a destination resort case in Douglas County where, in our opinion, and it's been remanded back to the county on a number of other issues, but in our opinion it was really nothing more than a hotel in an adjacent 200-house subdivision, and it was identified in the application simply as being a subdivision as potentially just serving people who lived in Sutherland for housing. That is, in our opinion, not what a destination resort is designed to do. And, yes, we do have substantial concerns under current law that it could be abused to allow residential developments by increasing the amount of allowed residential development. We've only increased, I think, the opportunities or made more likely the opportunities that people would seek to use this as a loophole to building residential subdivisions in areas that are not planned for in the state.
Thank you.
Okay. Further? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you. I need a little bit of clarification regarding residential homes at a destination resort. And the one I'm most familiar with is Sun River. Is that considered a destination resort?
Chair Doyle, Representative Mona Sanderson, it is actually not considered a destination resort. It was built as a resort community, if I recall correctly, prior to the enactment or adoption of Goal 8 and the destination resort siting standards. So while we think of it, and I don't think it's necessarily always inaccurate to think of that as a destination resort, it technically doesn't have the components. It does have a fair number of homes.
Beside that, what I want to do is take an example of what I'm familiar with at, say, Sun River. Say eight families want to buy a home that's located at a destination site, and that's what they do. Eight families buy a residential home, and that they use it as not as a residence, but as a place where they go and have a wonderful time. And I would love to see more of those throughout the state. So, tell me, in your mind, then, is a it doesn't matter whether eight families own it or one family owns it?
Chair Doyle, Representative Mona Sanderson, no. Actually, I would agree exactly with that. I think that there were ideally two types of homes. There was some recognition back in the sort of deep throes of legislative history that a few people might live there year-round, but not very many. The idea was that we would have this pool of overnight lodging accommodations for people coming in from out of state or from wherever, intrastate travel as well. But then there would also be second vacation homes, perhaps homes such as the one that you described, owned by multiple families, used as a vacation home, not as a year-round residence. But there is nothing in current statute that prohibits people from residing in those homes as year-round residences. There are some. The numbers are not particularly good, though the proponents of this bill did try to come up with some description. But there are some areas where we are seeing people certainly utilizing these homes as full-time residences and higher percentages than, in our policy opinion, is appropriate for a destination resort.
Thank you. Right. Further, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you aware of any particular plans that might be involved with this bill? In terms of development that would require this bill to be passed as compared to the current law?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, no, I'm not. There certainly is a development in Crook County. Well, they've filed their application, so it's unclear as to whether or not this could become applicable to them. I believe that there, I don't know if any other applications particularly that are being talked about at this time, any that would particularly benefit from this or those that would not be able to be cited as a result of this bill. I don't know of any.
One follow-up. Do you know if this bill has any relationship at all to the military department in the state of Oregon?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, not to my knowledge at all.
Thank you very much.
Nor to collective bargaining. Any further questions? Representative Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you comment on Section 1, Subsection 2, as to how you interpret that?
Representative Berger, I'm assuming you're talking about on page one of the
one.
Bill,
yes.
Lines 9
high value crop area.
High value crop area is, and this is where the actually the amendments on the last page come into play with respect to the adoption of the map. High value crop area is considered a concentration of commercial farms that are capable of producing $1,000 per acre per year. Typically, many of those agricultural areas that we would see would be areas like orchard lands, areas where we have a lot of row crops. It is not simply just one farm, but rather, the question is it two or three or more? But ideally, the county is mapping to identify what a concentration is of their most highly productive agricultural area in their county and protecting that from through the mapping process by the implementation of a buffer of 3 miles, protecting those areas from the adverse consequences that intensive agricultural operations frequently face as a result of residential or other resort or other kinds of non-farm development.
Follow up. Do you agree that the mapping standards are, I can't put my hand on it right now, but are $20,000 per project or?
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, I don't have any idea of the cost of to counties. I would also just like to note for the record for the committee that the mapping process is one way that destination resorts can be cited. They can also go through the exceptions process, which some counties have chosen to avail themselves of. One destination resort that I think we can all agree is a destination resort is Abandoned Dunes Destination Resort. I'm not here to promote or demote any particular resort, but I would note that resort has been successfully built with no residential homes, only overnight lodging accommodations. And they just went through an expansion application in which they did not request or receive approval for any residential homes. So I don't, some resorts may choose to have that as part of their plan. Other resorts certainly are not and are being successful in their desires to do so.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair Doyle. Carrie, Representative Montes Anderson asked about Sun River as being a destination resort. You said it was not. What about Black Butte or Eagle Crest?
Chair Doyle, Representative Backlund, Eagle Crest has been approved under the Goal 8 siting standards. Black Butte, I believe, was approved pre-Goal 8. I have actually a list, I think, in the back of the room of which ones were approved under which process. Sun River, I believe, is specifically designated in Deschutes County's plan, and I might look back to other people who are going to know this better than I, as a resort community, recognizing that they are going to have more year-round use. They have a higher level of commercial use than we typically see or are intending to see under the Goal 8 destination resort process. I'm not certain how Black Butte is classified, but Eagle Crest, yes, has been gone through the Goal 8 process, at least for its last expansion.
Well, it's interesting. I appreciate your answers. I suspect, though, that if we were to ask Oregonians who have visited any of those three places, Sun River, Black Butte, Eagle Crest, the Oregonian would say that this is a destination resort. That's the way he would view it, and that's the way he would treat it. By definition, it may not work, however. I understand that.
Representative Backlund, if I can, that's why I said it when I answered Representative Monis Anderson's question. I do think that there are some elements, certainly, of those developments, particularly with respect to their proximity to areas of recreational uses and what they provide on site, that are certainly akin in what we would expect to be seeing in a destination resort.
All right.
One more. What would you put in this law to deal with your question of your problem of the pretend resort, which is really just residential housing with a hotel? How would you fix that?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, one issue is the level of investment that one places in developed recreational facilities. We recommended particularly that amount of investment be increased, particularly since we were sort of saying this destination resort was now going to accommodate more people. The level of developed recreational facilities at a destination resort is one of the main things that draws people there. It's important to have a high level of those at the sites. We also recommended that there be clarification as to those being active outdoor recreational pursuits, so that we weren't, as we saw in one case, have a internet cafe be presented as one of the recreational amenities available. We also recommended that there be greater proximity, greater distance between large metropolitan areas or larger metropolitan areas and where the destination resort was sited, to ensure that they could not be bedroom communities. Current law requires that there be 24 air miles between a UGB and a destination resort of greater than 100,000 in population. We recommended reducing that to 50,000 in population to ensure that these didn't become commuting, residential areas. There are, a couple of other ways we can look at how to ensure that when destination resorts expand, that is an opportune time perhaps to review how many people are living there as permanent residents, and perhaps to disallow expansions if we see that it has really been built as or has evolved into a residential community, cutting our losses, maybe, if you will, for lack of a better way of describing it, in terms of that. Those are some of the ideas that we had. We actually did have draft amendments prepared for those. I would be happy to share them with you, though you may move into a work session and that might not be able to, I guess, be addressed in this forum.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Appreciate
thank
your testimony.
You.
And no one further testifying on this, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 911 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 911. Colleagues, first, just to address the Dash 8 amendments, I appreciate Mr. Schlack's concerns and the concerns of the counties. I also see that, at least from my sense in the testimony, was that these are things that would be nice to have clarified but may not actually be necessary. And I think normally I'd probably go ahead and offer these amendments to put them into the bill. We have another issue that the chamber is going to be voting on tomorrow that will most likely determine how long we're going to be in session. And we could be finished fairly quickly, depending on the results of that vote tomorrow. And for that reason, giving full credit to Mr. Schleck's lobbying abilities, that I have no doubt he could probably get some things accomplished in a matter of only a couple of days, I would just as soon still go forward just with the bill as it is, with the provision that if for some reason things don't happen as expected tomorrow, that it does look like we're going to stay here a little bit longer than expected, we can always pull the bill back in, make the changes, send it over to the Senate again for concurrence or to get this fixed. So if that's agreeable with the committee, I think it's worthwhile just to go forward with the bill as is. If we are going to be here longer, we can always pull this bill back before we vote for it on the floor, get the amendments fixed, or use this as fixed. Representative Mona Sanderson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with your assessment there, but I would like to say I really do wish that the amendments would be incorporated in. Just knowing that when we're changing maps, there's a cost to the county, and it would be nice to have them develop a process for collecting and processing all of the map amendments that they need to have. So it's too bad that this is brought at this point in time, but I hope we can honor your word that if things move really quickly, if it doesn't move quickly, we can...
We'll pull it back.
We'll pull it back and put the amendment in. Otherwise, we're going to have to address this next session.
All right. Happy to do that. Representative Flores, want to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 911 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 911 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
I just want to get on record. Usually I am very environmentally concerned, but I really love destination resorts. That's one of the things that I like to do, go to, and I would like to see them. The ones that I have attended are well planned very thoughtfully and fit in the beautiful natural resources that we have here. And if we want to promote tourism, in a sense we can consider this a jobs bill and an economic development bill, and that's why I'm going to be supporting the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a strong supporter of destination resorts. I think that we've heard what the problems are with the both the current law and with this bill, and the problem, of course, is the possibility that you end up with simply a way of playing urban leapfrog, which is precisely the thing the land use plan is intended to avoid. I'd love to have a bill that makes certain that a destination resort really is a destination resort, and that we promote tourism and promote Oregon's natural beauty, and we get people coming to visit us and participating in that through a properly planned and executed destination resort. Unfortunately, this bill doesn't seem to get us there.
Okay. Further discussion? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I have to agree with Representative Barnhart. I don't think there's any more beautiful place than Bandon Dunes, but I fear that... this is not exactly this opens a gate to me. It's just not exactly my vision of Oregon. So,
all right. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Excused.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
No.
Chair votes aye, and Representative Moss Anderson, you want to carry it?
Yes.
Oh, you love destination resorts? So that then will pass the floor, then, or go to the floor to do pass recommendation, Representative Moss Anderson, carry it. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 911, and colleagues, we need to, Representative Maude Sanderson wants to change her vote on House Bill 3510. Any objections to allowing Representative Maude Sanderson to change her vote to, or vote on House Bill 3510? It will not change the outcome.
Mr. Chair, perhaps we should have the representative give us a speech as to, no, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding.
All right, no objection, so ordered. Representative Maude Sanderson, how do you go?
Thank you. I vote no, and I want to clarify that. It was brought to my attention that there will be maybe a $200,000 fiscal impact with that bill, and also the reason that it was, and when it was dealt with in the Transportation Committee, it was under the assumption that it would go to Ways and Means and die. And so I want to vote no.
Yeah. All right. Let's see, open up a public hearing then on Senate Bill 920. And ask Ray Kelly to come and help us out as administrator. And let's these two. Oh, okay. There is a work group that has put together Senate Bill 920, and that's Linda Ludwig, John Chandler, Art Schlack, and Burton Wiest. Now, trying to decide among yourselves what you're going to do, how you're going to present this. Oh, nobody's going to say this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Actually, there are many more than just the four members of the work group, and let me touch base on who they were. It's a long-term work group over a period of about 6 months. The League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, Special Districts Association, 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Metro, the Oregon City Planning Directors Association, the Governor's Office, DLCD, LCDC, and Mr. Chandler, who never really quite disclosed who he was representing in the work group.
Forces of goodness, Mr. Chairman.
You have
got a new client. I see.
Pretty good.
That was good.
Touché. You have seen a former version of Senate Bill 920A, House Bill 929, that did come out of the House Environment and Land Use Committee with unanimous vote, moved along the House floor over to the Senate with quite a strong vote on the House floor, went over to Senate Water Committee, Water and Land Use Committee, Water and Environment Committee, where it stalled with a number of other land use bills. It was reconfigured as a Senate Rules Committee bill and comes before you again. Basically, what the bill does is it takes some preliminary steps in streamlining the periodic review program while still continuing to support all the tenets of the land use planning program, the statutes, goals, and administrative rules. The reason the bill came about, a couple of reasons, really and truly. Many, many jurisdictions are in periodic review currently. Over one half of all Oregon's counties, about a third of the cities are currently in periodic review programs. And there are quite a number of outstanding work tasks. During the course of that 6 months, we tried to put our arms around how many work tasks there are. And we determined probably between about 300 and 400 outstanding ones. That's a tremendous number of work tasks. Some of them that have, for a variety of reasons, have been sitting there for some time. It became a larger problem knowing that the budget reductions we were going to see this session would probably also be reducing DLCD staff in order to be able to be working and processing these work tasks. So Senate Bill 920 comes before you. It does three or four major main things. It suspends any new periodic review work programs or tasks for about 4 years. There are a couple of different ways that some new tasks or programs can come online if they're absolutely very important to the local jurisdiction or to the department. but it sets aside a period of time for the department to be able to work through those existing work tasks. It organizes an interim committee that will look at long-term changes to the periodic review program, look at things such as the balancing of program requirements with resources both on the state and local side of the equation. And that interim committee will come back with recommendations to the 05 legislative session. The bill also focuses, as some previous legislation tried to, DLCD's time, staff attention in periodic review to the issues of urban development, housing, transportation, economic development, infrastructure, and the movement of urban growth boundaries. And lastly, we believe an important component of the bill is setting up an advisory committee for DLCD's general fund grants, which come as periodic review grants and technical assistance grants, setting up a committee for recommendations such as the TGM committee, the Transportation Growth Management Committee, which has been a very, very effective body for the department to receive recommendations from. So it's kind of the history of the bill, a little bit of the highlights of what it does, and I know the hour is late. I'd love to ask Mr. Chandler if he has additional comments from you or take any questions.
No. Go ahead, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, in addition to the Forces of Goodness, or also representing the Oregon Building Industry Association. As Ms. Ludwig indicated, this was a work group that was met over many months, and for those of you who've been involved in land use issues, and particularly periodic review issues, you can only guess how fun it was to sit and talk periodic review every week for a number of months. The periodic review process, very, very simply, is the way local government plans are. The state ensures that they're kept up to snuff with changes in the law, changes in LCDC requirements, and so on, so forth. As a matter of theory, that routine cleaning and scraping, if you will, is a good idea. The way it's worked out, it hadn't helped anybody. It hadn't helped the local governments. It's clogged up the state system, and my clients, whose interest in the land use system is to have the darn thing work well, aren't very happy about it either, because it isn't. That's why we were at the table on this work group. We think 920 is a very good bill. We had the department's participation and support, the governor's office involvement, all the other groups that Ms. Ludwig mentioned, and we recommend it to you. It's a good fix. It doesn't address any of the longer-term, big-picture issues. It's simply procedural. How does the department get through their process in a timely fashion, particularly in light of the budget cuts? I'm glad to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
All right. Any questions? Getting off easy. Thank you.
And we need a cold compress for Representative Barnhart.
Cold
compress.
Mr. Slack, Mr. Weiss, you didn't have anything to add? No. Okay.
Good bill should pass.
All right. Harlan Levy? Okay, another good bill should pass. Nan Evans.
Well, sure, I'll say it. Mr. Chair, while she's coming up, I wanted to give notice of a possible minority report on Senate Bill 911.
Oh, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Evans. I'm the interim director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It is tempting to say me too, and I will do that. It is a good bill that resulted from a good process. The department is very cognizant of the issues around periodic review. There were times during this work group when the problem was sometimes described as being the bunny and the boa, which is kind of one of those things. But anyway, clearing the lump and the snake might be another expression of how to get the process just cleared out a little bit. We are committed to doing that. There are lots of reasons why that lump exists in the snake. Some of them are reasons at the local levels, having to do with resources, staffing, the nature of the issues that local jurisdictions have to deal with. Some of the reasons are at the state level, priorities, workload, budget. Just in the last 6 months, we've managed to clear the workload at the state level in my department by about 50%. There are about 35 tasks left in our office, but this bill will move it through faster. One other issue just to briefly mention that was discussed in the Senate when this bill sort of revitalized itself as Senate Bill 920. There is a provision in the bill in two places that requires LCDC to pay the costs of local governments during year 3 and 4 of the bill for any jurisdiction that LCDC believes that there is a significant state reason, state interest, that LCDC would reach down and say to local jurisdiction, you know, you really ought to be in periodic review and fix these issues. There's a provision in the bill that if LCDC chooses to do that, LCDC would pay the cost. The discussion in the Senate and on the floor of the Senate to clarify what that meant was simply that we have in the department a grants program, and that's the process we use to assist local jurisdictions, and that process involves sort of a negotiation up front with the local jurisdiction about the nature of the task and the amount of money that LCDC will pay. And I just bring this to your attention because of the potential fiscal arrangements around there. There's not a fiscal on the bill because we believe we do have adequate funding in our grant program to help local any local jurisdiction that might be in that situation. So with that, I would answer any questions.
All right. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nan, this is not a question. This is a statement. But it's been almost cruel to me to see what some small cities have had to go through without the resources and have been put in periodic review. I just wonder why it's taken us so long.
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, was that a question? Representative Berger, we have tried to look at that. The reasons, and I want to try to answer your question, but I'm sure I won't probably do it to your satisfaction because they're very complex reasons, and there are multitudes of reasons. Some of them are simply that some of the issues are so very controversial locally, particularly issues around wetlands and wetland protection. It's very hard for local jurisdictions to get through that. We try to provide funding. We try to leverage some funding through the Department of State Lands to do the mapping that's required. But it is expensive, and it is controversial. Sometimes the issues at the local jurisdictions are simply changeover in staff. We see a lot of that at the local level. And some of it is also, you know, the priorities of what they're doing at the local government. A periodic review might not be the highest priority issue facing a local planning commission. At the state level, we have tried to support the local jurisdictions. We do have a grant program for local jurisdictions to do both plan amendment and periodic review. The level of that program, the 0103 biennium, was about $2.2 million, I believe. The level of that program under the budget that was passed recently for the 0305 biennium, I believe, is $1.9 million. That's simply not a lot of money when you have, you know, 200 and some jurisdictions.
Yeah, I want follow up, please, Mr. Chairman. Sure. I just want to say in closing, thank you for the money that did come for coastal programs that you enabled us to help some struggling periodic review cities. And this is a good bill.
Further questions? Nan, just I guess going back to one of your points, we had the fiscal summary prepared by Legislative Fiscal Office that states recognizes that as the backlog gets resolved, DLCD may be able to reprioritize existing resources. And then one of the statements that are made by the Legislative Fiscal Officer or analyst was that DLCD believes it will be able to absorb the work created by that committee if other work decreases as a result of this bill. Is that still your position?
Chair Doyle, that's my hope.
Okay. Any further? Thank you for testimony. All right, no one else scheduled to testify then. We can close the public hearing on Senate Bill 920. And open up a work session on Senate Bill 920. President Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 920 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
President Flores moves Senate Bill 920 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? All right. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Chair votes aye, and I will carry this one on the floor. And that passes Senate Bill 920 to the floor. Let's then close the work session on Senate Bill 920, open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 934, and it's Janet Atkins to return as our administrator. And Cindy Robert, come on forward. And Carol Halford.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good evening. My name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the American Institute of Architects. With me today is Carol Halford. She's the administrator of the Oregon Board of Architect Examiners. That board is a licensing and discipline board that's in charge of protecting the health, safety, and welfare of your citizens against architects and others purporting to be architects. I would say we don't normally come to a table and sit together, but in this case we are because this is a good bill. It is actually a combination of two bills that passed the Senate, Senate Bill 209, Senate Bill 210. They passed the Senate unanimously, both the government committee they were in and then the full Senate, and then came over here to the business committee. And as the chair of the business committee will tell you, the bills had caused some concern for one interest group. And once we found out there was concern, and once the board found out there was concern, they asked me to get involved and help them to draft some amendments, which I did. Everyone agreed upon them. It was all happy, huggy, huggy, and time ran out. So, hence we're back. This bill, Senate Bill 934, encompasses Senate Bill 209, Senate Bill 210, and the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 210, which were agreed upon by everyone involved, including the construction industry people that were concerned about it. So it's a good bill. It has everything it should have in it. I believe that Representative Close, the chair of the Business Committee, was going to support it going forward and help me actually to get it started in the Senate Rules Committee again. So, and again, I was just asked to help out as someone who was involved here every day and had nothing to do. I was asked to help out the Board of Architect Examiners, which is actually a state board, so they don't have any legislative help. With that, I told Carol to be ever so brief, and she'll explain to you what the details of the bill are, and hopefully if you have any questions, one of us can answer them.
All right. Salford?
Representative Doyle, members of the committee, thanks for listening to me today. The Architect Board is asking you to support this bill. Senate Bill 934 is generally a housekeeping bill, and there are some important points to it, however, that the Architect Board would like to bring your attention to. There's really five short things. In order to be consistent with national model law, this bill would change the phrase protecting the public by safeguarding the life, health, safety, and property that's used in our statutes to protecting the health, safety, and welfare, which is, again, consistent with the national model rules. The bill also changes a title of suspended in good standing status to an inactive status, which is more accurate and sounds less like a disciplinary thing. The bill also clarifies the license renewal deadlines are due July 1st, which has been the practice of the board for the past 11 years. And this bill also clarifies there's a fee not only for taking the architect examination, but for applying to be determined eligible to sit for that exam. And lastly, this bill would allow architects licensed in another state and also in another country to affiliate with an Oregon registered architect and either use the title of consulting architect or foreign architect. That would provide an incentive for quality architects to assist with and collaborate on Oregon projects. So this bill allows the board to be a little more clear and a little better organized, and the board is asking for your support. If you'd like, I'd answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Barnard.
If I may, you know, I'm sorry I may have missed it, but what was the amendment that you made to SB 210?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart. Actually, the amendment had to do more with, we were trying to clean up the statute so that there were some things that you had to do in order to fall under architect's law and be a licensed architect, and certain things that exempted people could still do even though they weren't architects. And the way the bill was originally written, and the board and legislative council kind of followed it between each other, and I just tried to fix it, so I'm not sure really where the problem came down, but some said that the legislative council wrote it in a way that made it confusing, and others said that was kind of the way it was drafted originally. But when it came down to it, I checked out the amendments with both Scott Berry and Sean Miller, and both of them were more comfortable with the language change because it made it almost look like it was harder for a construction contractor to fall into the exemption for practicing architecture just during the alignment. So we put the alignment back. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Any further questions? All right, thank you for testifying.
Thank you very much.
And no one else is scheduled to testify on Senate Bill 934, so we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 934, open up a work session on Senate Bill 934. Senator Forrest?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 934 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Forrest has moved Senate Bill 934 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? All right, call the roll, please.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
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 The chair votes aye. And Representative Beckham, want to carry? Thank you. Then Senate Bill 934 will move to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And that closes the work session on Senate Bill 934. And nothing further before the committee. We are adjourned.
Thank you.